On the program today, there will be a word you won't hear. There will be words you will hear, though, and they include central bank, coronavirus, Amazon, and train daddy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 24th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Two things as we get going today. Number one, I'm going to say it now, and then you won't have to hear it again for the next half an hour. Anyway, impeachment. There you go. It's out of the way. Item number two, this has been kind of a curious week, macroeconomically speaking. There is medical news that's relevant. There is central banking news that's of import. We got it all. Analysis and explanation forthcoming from Neela Richardson. She's at Edward Jones. David Gura, you can catch him on MSNBC. They are right now, both of them in our studios in New York. Hey.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So, Neela, let me start with you, and I want to frame it this way. I do not want to be alarmist in any way about the coronavirus. But you know how we've been saying for a long time that this expansion is long in the tooth, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you know how Janet Yellen and everybody says economic expansions don't die of old age. They die from what economists like to call exogenous shocks, shocks from the outside.
I'm following you here.
Could the coronavirus be what we're talking about here?
I don't think so.
Okay,
actually, what the Fed generally says is that economic expansions are murdered by the Federal Reserve hiking up rates. So I think that that's off the table for now. You know, I think perspective here is really warranted. If you think about how many people die from the flu, that's 21,000 to 61,000 a year annually, estimated by the CDC. So that tells us two things. One, it's not too late to go get a flu shot. Yeah. Flu season lasts till May. Yeah. And two, the scale is really important here. Even though these deaths are tragic and sad, the quick response on behalf of public health officials is really important in containing this disease and keeping it from being some kind of global economic event.
David?
I want to disagree a little bit. I mean, I think that what we've seen here over these last few days, China closing down whole cities, quarantining whole cities, is something pretty extraordinary. And I was talking to an epidemiologist today who said back when SARS was a big thing in the early 2000s, that did a ton of damage to China's economy. So there's this underlying awareness throughout China of how bad that was. And it was mishandled. It was badly handled. But I think that the global economy took a hit of like $40 billion because of that disease. And there is a lot at play here based on when this is happening. Chinese New Year is coming up. This is a city of 11 million people. We know how interconnected the country is and the world is as well. So I echo a lot of the caution and how you're tempering things. But I do think that it is a moment where we come to grips with or we understand how interconnected everything is. And you know, that might not play out in the most traumatic or devastating way. But once again, it reinforces the fact that there is so much at stake here that affects us, you know, thousands and thousands of miles away.
Well, I'm going to go with Neela's version, actually, David. So, you know, whatever. My show, pal. I can do what I want.
There you go.
Go ahead, Neela.
And the Chinese economy did rebound. David's absolutely right. It shrank from 10% to single digits, but then rebounded over the second half of that year. So, again, tragic circumstances, but in terms of the economy, not generally long-lasting effects in our view.
Fair enough. Neela, you mentioned the Federal Reserve, and I want to just turn quickly to the European Central Bank, which this week said, first of all, it's holding rates steady, negative rates, and it's also going to reevaluate its approach to monetary policy strategy, which is something that the Federal Reserve has said it's doing. And I wonder what you make, as the trained economist in this conversation, of the fact that central banks seem to keep getting things wrong, inflation, wages and growth. I mean, you know, why do we listen to them?
Well, first, let's be clear. They're getting things wrong in the right way for the markets because the markets are rallying over low interest rates and low inflation. But this is a puzzle for the Fed. They can't figure out why they can't move inflation expectations higher, closer to their 2% target. And there is a variety of reasons that the Fed is going to point to for why inflation seems stuck and low. But the reason it isn't really important, and we don't have time to get into all of it anyway, the outcome is extremely important. And that outcome means the Fed can let the economy run hot and the job market stay tight. And so for that reason, you can see that this economic expansion is likely to persist and prolong.
Well, so let me actually jump down on my list of questions, David. And it's something I talked with Sudeep about last week. The idea of the economic expansion and the president's campaign on it, which we see when he makes his speeches. At what point do you think the economy gets fixed in voters' minds and they coast into the election from there, if you take my meaning?
That's a great question, and I'm not going to repeat the word you said at the top of the show just in deference to you.
I appreciate that. Stay with the theme, man.
There are all manner of distractions, let's say, that voters are facing at this point. And you have a president who traveled over to Europe this week and gave a speech to a warm reception in Davos. And he hit the Fed in interviews. You know, he looked at growth. He looked at where things are and blamed the Fed once again. He's going to keep hitting it. I think voters are aware of that. Obviously, we've talked many times before just about what's working for the economy and what's not. I think that there are voters who are aware of that. I don't know when that's going to happen. I think there are a lot of his advisors who wish that he would talk about it more than he is talking about it. But I think that at this point in time, it feels more forced. Do you disagree? I'm looking at Neil over here.
Neil, what do you think?
I
can't see you.
You know, that he could be talking about it. He's not talking about it. And there's just sort of a general sense of complacency about where things stand at this point.
Neil, thoughts?
Well, you know, the economy has been humming along rather nicely, and it's been on the backs of the consumer. And most presidents do take credit for that, front and center. So I think that that will actually pick up as we get closer to the election. If the economy stays on sound footing, there's much to revel in if you're leading this country.
Okay, fair enough. Very quick turn to trade, David. You mentioned Davos. The president took a swing over there. Also, the new managing director of the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva, did some panels. And she said, in regards to the China trade deal and USMCA, which is going to be signed next week, she said, a trade truce is great. A trade peace is what we need. Are we going to get there, do you think?
I don't think that we're going to get there soon. I think we have had something of a of a break in how heated things were before, and I think that the rhetoric has become less hot than it was. But there's still a lot of open questions. I was talking to some folks who run restaurants who are still very worried about the fact that there could be an increase on tariffs for European imports on wine and specialty goods. There are all of these X factors that exist. They aren't talked about a lot in the way that USMCA or the China-US trade deal has been talked about. But there are residual effects of the president's rhetoric that are still, I think, of concern to a lot of market participants.
Neil, go ahead.
On this, David and I, again, agree. You know, this is death by a thousand tariffs or tariff cuts, not cuts yet. But there is an overhang in trade uncertainty. Yes, cautious optimism because of this interim deal. But tariffs are not gone and they're not forgotten. And new tariffs could be in the foreseeable future. Mm-hmm. And so for that reason, I don't think you're going to see a euphoric response to the trade deal that we have on the table now.
I mean, the Commerce Secretary was talking about him like yesterday morning, so it's
definitely
still out there. Neil Richardson at Edward Jones and David Gurry, you can catch him weekends on MSNBC. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.
Have a nice weekend. Wall Street at the end of this curious week. Not so good, really. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are varying opinions about the economic seriousness of the coronavirus, as you heard from David and Neela. But the facts are that something like 30 million people in China are virtually locked down. 26 people are dead. More than 800 are infected. And the virus has spread to six other countries, including the United States. Back in China, though, Marketplace's Jennifer Pack is in Shanghai. That's about 500 miles from the center of the outbreak.
It's the eve of the Lunar New Year. Many shops are closed in Shanghai, but not Qiu Jianxian's fruit stand.
This time last year, there were a lot of people walking by, but there aren't so many now. Many won't leave their homes because of coronavirus.
Many of those who are leaving their homes, like Zhou Lin Guo, are still staying in Shanghai only.
Normally, I would travel abroad or go back to my hometown in the central Henan province.
But this is the height of the New Year celebrations, when Chinese people typically make some 400 million trips over the week-long holiday. So despite the coronavirus, many have still decided to travel. Helen Jin and her family flew from northeastern China to Shanghai yesterday. They came prepared with face masks and say they'll avoid crowded places.
We planned to go to the Shanghai Disneyland Park, but now we've canceled.
Actually, Shanghai Disneyland plans to close its doors Saturday, but Shanghai itself is not under lockdown. Even so, resident Edwin Yang still worries.
Our media doesn't report everything. If the virus spreads, it'll be quick because the population of Shanghai and China is dense.
That's why people like Zhang Liying are avoiding contact with friends and relatives. She left Shanghai this week to visit her parents in eastern Zhejiang province.
My father planned to gather with his brothers and sisters over the holiday, but then yesterday we heard there was a confirmed case of the coronavirus in a village 6 miles away, so my father canceled all the dinner reservations at the restaurant.
Sit-down restaurants may be taking a hit, but not all businesses are suffering. Some pharmacies and online shops can't keep enough face masks in stock, and people still want to celebrate with restaurant meals. Food delivery man Zhao Rong says he's getting a lot of orders.
A lot of people don't want to leave their homes, so they ask us to pick up their food for them.
People's fear of contracting the virus has made him much busier than last Lunar New Year. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
I learned something new and vaguely disturbing today, that Andy Byford, who resigned this week as the head of the New York City subway system, is sometimes referred to in that city as Train Daddy. That aside, the news of Byford's departure after just 2 years on the job is of note because of what that subway system means to the infrastructure of the most economically important city in this country. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more.
Ask a New Yorker what they think about the subway, and you'll probably hear something like what we heard from Peter Tarr, a commuter passing through Grand Central.
This system is a disaster. It was underfunded. It was not maintained properly. It's a disgrace.
A failing subway system isn't just irritating. It has a real impact on the economy. New York City generates almost 5% of the country's GDP, more if you include nearby counties. And a failing subway system has consequences.
Just like if your circulatory system is not working, the rest of you can't function either.
Sarah Kaufman of NYU's Rudin Center for Transportation met me on the platform of the Bleecker Street station.
Business not being done in the city because people are stuck in the subway. Meetings don't happen. Deals don't get made.
But while Andy Byford's been on the job, things improved. Kaufman says he focused on necessary changes, like updating the system's ancient signals, helping increase accessibility, and speeding up the trains. The MTA says last year, 80% of trains were on time. That's up from 67% the year before. Riders have noticed that, and other changes. Russell West takes the 2 and 3 trains to Harlem.
I've appreciated how more forthright they've been. Like, you know what's going on a bit more than I remember knowing what was going on before he got here.
Supporters also say Byford's appeal came down to simply acknowledging that the New York City subway was a disaster.
He didn't blow smoke. He didn't tell us that he could fix something that he knew he couldn't fix.
City Council member Justin Brannon met me on the platform of the City Hall station.
That goes a really long way, a really long way, especially when New Yorkers are so used to being told by agencies, there's nothing to see here, these aren't the droids you're looking for, keep moving.
In a statement, Byford said the MTA will still go forward with its $51 billion capital improvement plan. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And we'll charge that once the money starts coming in.
Big government contractors and how they handle government shutdowns. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 170 points today, about 0.5%, closed at 28,989. The NASDAQ off 87 points, about 0.9%, 93.14. The S&P 500 gave back 30 points, 0.9% there as well, 32.95. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow off 1.2%, the NASDAQ 0.7% to the downside, the S&P 500 off 1%. Intel up 8.1% today after posting solid gains in fourth quarter revenue and forecasting 2020 earnings higher than analysts expected. Rival NVIDIA down 0.9%. American Express rushed up 2.8% today on better-than-expected revenue growth. Visa down 0.7%. Bonds rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note thus fell down to 1.68%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. A little bit more now on the coronavirus and the economic risks it might pose. Limited so far, to be sure, but worth keeping an eye on. It's hitting during Chinese New Year, as Jennifer was telling us, the biggest holiday of the year over there, which means it's hitting what is now a critical and growing part of the Chinese economy. Services, travel and tourism, shopping and entertainment as well, areas that have really been firing, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Chinese factories are struggling from the U.S. trade war, but China's overall economy is still growing at 6% because of its service economy. Retail, transportation, hotels, all that. Tom Orlick is chief economist at Bloomberg Economics.
One of the big successes for China's policymakers has been a rebalancing away from an old, clunking, heavily polluting industrial sector towards a larger role for the services.
Services now at risk because the virus is keeping people home. Take the movies. The film Chinatown Police 3 canceled its mainland premiere, as did six others. Travel is down, as is eating out. Economist Mohammed El-Aryan, an advisor to Allianz, says the service slowdown could spill over to the rest of the world.
If you are even a U.S. company that flies people to the impacted areas, you're going to be impacted. The longer this uncertainty lasts, the more the spillovers start to cascade.
During China's SARS virus 17 years ago, growth dipped and came right back. Now, though, Michael Herson at the Eurasia Group says China's economy is much bigger and much more globally linked.
And that's why you see cruise lines and tourism casinos being impacted by this in ways that they weren't when SARS hit.
One bright spot could be video games for Chinese stuck at home. The top game in China is called Plague. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
If you go to Amazon right now and try to post a review of the new book American Dirt, you will get this message. Amazon has noticed unusual reviewing activity on this product. Due to this activity, we have limited this product to verified purchase reviews. That is, purchases of the book made on Amazon. The novel at hand, American Dirt, again by Janine Cummins, is a story of a Mexican family fleeing gang violence. It has won both widespread praise and widespread criticism, in part because its author is neither Mexican nor an immigrant, and it has raised questions of representation and cultural appropriation. The whole thing has also raised a business question about what kind of platform Amazon wants to be. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
David Bowles read an advance copy of American Dirt. He's a Mexican-American author and had some critiques. So
I went ahead and purchased the Kindle version of it so that I could have a verified purchase and thereby have my review published, because I thought it was important to get it out there.
Amazon is not only a huge seller of books, but a place where lots of people come to talk about them. Writer and publisher Victoria Barrett says Amazon has cultivated that conversation by buying Goodreads, a reader review site.
If they want to keep the discussion about race and appropriation out of their website, that's certainly their right. But because they have invited this social function into their retail business, it feels a little like dirty pool to a lot of us in the industry, I think.
Amazon wouldn't answer questions about why it restricted American Dirt reviews or how often this happens with books. Its page for A Very Stable Genius, a new book critical of President Trump, also only allows reviews by verified buyers. Amazon's not the only review site grappling with how to manage speech. Rotten Tomatoes recently started verifying ticket purchases by reviewers to prevent review bombing. Corinne McSherry with the Electronic Frontier Foundation says Amazon is in a different category because of its size and influence in the marketplace.
Amazon is actually the site of so much expression. So I would urge Amazon to be extremely cautious in going down this path, and it may regret it.
because, she says, people will gravitate to the platforms where they can be heard. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
One of the things that happens with economic shocks is that the after effects can play out for a good long while once whatever the shock was has faded. The financial crisis is the best example. We are still dealing with the fallout from that, as we tell you every now and then. A more recent example is last year's government shutdown that ended a year ago tomorrow. In fact, the 25th of January. Federal employees didn't get paid for more than a month. Yes, they got back pay. But still, right? Lots of federal contractors, though, weren't so lucky. Some still haven't recovered from that economic shock. And as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains, with the federal government increasingly relying on contractors, things could be worse the next time.
Alasia Stevens used to be a security guard at the Lincoln Memorial, making about $12 an hour. She worked for the temporary staffing agency the government hired to handle monument security until the shutdown started on December 22, 2018, and she was temporarily laid off.
You know, the busiest time of the year, you know, the most stressful time of the year, and it's like you pick that month.
Stevens shares a three-bedroom apartment in suburban Maryland with her four sons, her boyfriend, and her sister. Stevens is the main breadwinner and homework enforcer.
And do your homework. What are you doing?
I don't even know if I have homework.
Yes, you do.
As her sons settle in with their schoolwork, Stevens recounts how the shutdown ruined Christmas that year.
I bought them some shoes, and that's all that I was able to buy them. That was about it.
A week into the shutdown, Stevens decided she couldn't afford to wait it out. So she quit her security job and went to work at a restaurant. But while she waited for that first paycheck, she still had to cover her expenses, about $800 a month for food.
My rent is $1,308. My truck is $518.
Stevens ran up her credit cards and still owes about $1,200.
And I was just devastated. Like, I went into such a hole during that time. You know, so I'm still crawling out that hole.
To get out of that hole faster, Stevens went back to work for a government contractor as a security guard at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. The money was better, but she still lives paycheck to paycheck and could find herself out of work if the government shuts down again. Federal agencies are increasingly relying on contractors to provide janitors, parking lot attendants, even kitchen staff. Laura Padin is a senior staff attorney at the National Employment Law Project.
There is a huge uptick and clearly a huge dependence, increasing dependence on these temporary help services.
Padin says the amount of money paid to temporary staffing agencies doubled during the first 2 years of the Trump administration to $1.7 billion in 2018. There are all kinds of federal contractors, data analysts, logistics managers, even contract specialists to oversee other contractors. NYU's Paul Light estimates about 1 million of them were affected by the shutdown. But he says big companies, think defense contractors, they didn't lay off their mostly white-collar workers during the shutdown, thinking,
yep, we understand that we're not getting money. We're just going to let some things slip, or we're going to do some training, and we'll charge that once the money starts coming in.
Or they transferred workers to contracts not affected by the shutdown. David Berto heads the Professional Services Council, a trade group. He says the length of the shutdown, 35 days, made it harder for his members to plan and recruit top talent. Berto says one contractor had 17 new people lined up due to start during the shutdown.
And all of those people decided it's too risky going to work for a contractor who depends on the government, who is vulnerable to a government shutdown. We'll go take a job with another company.
And Arlesia Stevens, the security guard, she's keeping an eye out for another job, even one outside of government.
It's worrisome to know that everything could be taken away again, or, you know, just your money stops coming in.
Especially with four growing boys who, Stevens jokes, eat 23 hours a day. In Hillcrest Heights, Maryland, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Boeing catches a break. We have kept you up to speed on the company's challenges getting the 737 MAX back in the air, including the unfortunate use of the word this week, ungrounding. Boeing said earlier this week it's shooting for a mid-2020 return to service, but there are reports today the head of the FAA has called airlines and told them it could approve the plane's airworthiness certificate before mid-year. That would be a big deal for the carriers, obviously, and also the company. It's a sign that Boeing's try at a fresh start with regulators post-former CEO Dennis Muilenburg might be paying off, literally paying off. In fact, shares up 1.5% today, 1.6% actually, I think, in an otherwise down market. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's down 170 today. That's about 0.5%. The NASDAQ off 87 points, 0.9%. 93.14 there, by the way. The S&P 500 gave back 30 points, 0.9% there. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you on Monday. Everybody, have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.